Today, in A Mirror Darkly, the Property Imperative Weekly to the 7th of March 2020. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to a latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In the review of this week's news, we look at the market gyrations, central bank responses, and the limitations of monetary policy. And as normal, we start with the global scene. But if you want to jump direct to the Australian section, the time is shown below. And a quick reminder, due to YouTube's restrictions, I will only discuss the current medical situation obliquely, to avoid demonetization. I'll be using the term panic not 101. In the US, stocks closed in the red on Friday, but well off lows thanks to some late day buying in what was another hectic final hour of trading. At the close on the New York Stock Exchange, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 0.98% to 25,866, while the S&P 500 index lost 1.71% to 2,971, and the Nasdaq Composite fell 1.87% to 8,575. But then markets moved back close to their lows in the day in late trading, with investors likely nervous about staying long into the weekend that would be packed with medical-related headlines. Losses in the oil and gas, basic minerals, and financial sectors led shares lower. Volumes on the US exchanges were 14.2 billion shares, compared to 10.54 billion, which was the average over the last 20 session trading days. Data showing a robust pace of hiring in February largely went ignored, given that the data captured little of the impact from the panic not 101. A sharp downturn in later economic and corporate earnings data would likely strike a further blow to US markets, analysts said. The US Federal Reserve has begun quarantining physical dollars that it repatriates from Asia before recirculating them in the US financial system as a precautionary measure against spreading the virus. Regional Fed banks that help manage the money supply will set aside shipments of dollars from Asia for 7 to 10 days before processing and redistributing them to financial institutions. The policy, first reported by Reuters, was implemented on February the 21st. So the question is this another covert front in the war on cash? On average, the Fed distributes $34 billion in paper notes every year, according to the San Francisco Fed. A bill signed by President Donald Trump on Friday will provide $8.3 billion to bolster the country's capacity to test for panic not 101. Trump signed the legislation at the end of the week in which the virus began to disrupt daily life for many Americans. As stocks plunge and US companies grapple with the economic fallout, his administration is also weighing tax relief for the cruise, travel, and airline industries. The S&P 500 posted its 10th decline in 12 sessions as crippled supply chains prompted a sharp cut in global economic growth forecasts for 2020. Since its record closing high on February the 19th, the benchmark index has lost more than 12%, wiping out $3.43 trillion from its market capitalization. Even so, for the week, the S&P 500, along with the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the Nasdaq, posted a modest gain as stocks on Friday paired losses late in the session. Comments from the Federal Reserve officials about the possibility of using other tools in addition to interest rate cuts to blunt the economic impact of the panic not 101 helped stocks ease declines. The S&P 500 gained 0.6%, the Dow added 1.8%, and the Nasdaq rose 0.1%, but we still are in correction territory and the market has no means of assessing the emerging global uncertainties. The central bank has begun to grapple with what measures it could use if the outbreak of the illness worsens in the United States and causes a severe economic downturn. Federal Reserve Regional President Eric Rosengren participated in the Shadow Open Market Committee Economics Conference in New York. We should allow the central bank to purchase a broader range of securities or assets, Rosengren said in prepared remarks, noting that it would require a change to the Fed's mandate as set by Congress. The Fed, of course, slashed its key overnight lending rate by half a percentage point on Tuesday to a target range of between 1 and 1.25% in an emergency move to mitigate the effects of the escalating global panic not 101 outbreak in the US economy. Investors are predicting further US rate cuts in the near future. Rosengred said such an approach would be necessary because if the Fed was forced to slash rates to effectively zero, the circumstances would have changed that would limit the effectiveness of purchasing only Treasury and mortgage-backed securities, as the central bank did in the 2007-2009 recession. Those large-scale asset purchases or quantitative easing aim to stimulate the economy. What has changed is the drop in the 10-year US Treasury yield. It fell to a record low of 0.66% earlier on Friday, on pace for its largest daily fall since October 2011, during the depths of the Eurozone sovereign debt crisis, amid concerns the Panic Not 101 outbreak could cause a global recession. It ended at 0.773, down a massive 16.4%. The three-month rate dropped even more, down 18.16% to 0.51, so the yield curve is not inverted for now. There will be little room for the Federal Reserve to lower rates through large purchases of long-term Treasury securities, like it did to make conditions more accommodative in and after the Great Recession, if a recession occurred in this rate environment, Rosengren said. If the Fed did change its policy, it should be accompanied by agreement from the US Treasury to indemnify the central bank against losses, Rosengren added. And he did not specify what type of other securities or assets the Fed would buy. Rosengren also said he remains sceptical about introducing negative interest rates to the United States. Other central banks, including in Europe and in Japan, have pushed rates below zero. In my view, negative interest rates poorly position an economy to recover from a downturn, Rosengren said. In perfect timing, the IMF just released a paper, How Can Interest Rates Go Negative?, in which they discuss the negative interest rate experiment. Note this chilling comment in their penultimate paragraph. But the concern remains about the limits to negative interest rate policies so long as cash exists as an alternative. So here clearly is the link between the ban on cash and monetary policy. No conspiracy theory, just plain fact. The European Central Bank introduced negative interest rates in 2014 and the Bank of Japan followed in 2016. The German 10-year was up 1.92% to minus 0.7144. It is within striking distance of its record low set last September near minus 74 basis points. Now, of course, in Japan, the central bank there has been buying up a range of securities, including stocks, bonds, and frankly, anything that moves with value as they take the rate negative. Two-year notes in Japan currently yield minus 0.28%. If longer-dated US Treasury yields hover near zero, some see a risk that a new wave of buying could turn short-dated ones negative, even without the Fed adopting a negative policy. So monetary policy madness prevails. The volatility index, which measures the implied volatility of the S&P 500 options, was up 5.8% to 41.94, a new five-year high. This underscores the uncertainty in the markets. Gold futures for April delivery was up 0.38% to 1,674, so traders are placing their faith in that yellow metal. Gold jumped almost 7% on the week, its biggest weekly gain in 11 years. But elsewhere in commodities trading, WTI crude oil fell 9.34% to hit $41.61 a barrel after OPEC and Russia failed to come up with a deal expected to cut 1.5 million barrels per day off global supply. The US dollar index futures was down 0.75% at 96.06, while the euro US dollar was up 0.4% to 1.1284. Bitcoin was up 0.55% to 9,140 as more investors seek out places to store cash. Investors lowered bearish bets on the Chinese yuan as a US rate cut gave Chinese bonds a yield advantage. Aided by a weakening dollar, short positions on the Chinese yuan stood at their lowest since early January 2019. The yuan immediately jumped after the rate cut to its highest level since January 23rd and erased all the losses it had clocked up since the Lunar New Year holiday. It stood at 6.9373 at the close. The Shanghai index stood at 3,034, stronger than recently. Weaknesses in consumption in Japan to start the year lends credence to the idea that the world's third largest economy is contracting for the second consecutive quarter. Household spending fell 3.9% year over year, nearly matching economists' projections after a 4.8% decline in December. It is the fourth straight decline. Durable goods have been especially hard hit, led by a 10.7% decline in January order sales after an 11.1% decline in December. Some daily data suggests that after the school closures were announced in late February, there may have been a surge in necessity purchases. Labour cash earnings rose 1.5% year over year after a 0.2% fall in December, yet details may not be as favourable as the optics. Base pay did accelerate, but the real action came from the 10.2% jump in bonuses. Lastly, the January leading economic indicator fell from 91 to 90.3, its lowest level since 2009. The Japanese market dropped to a six-month low, with 97% of shares on the Tokyo Exchange's main board in the red. In London, Europe's financial capital, the Canary Wharf district was unusually quiet. S&P Global's large office stood empty after the company sent its 1,200 staff home, while HSBC asked around 100 people to work from home after a worker tested positive for the illness. The FTSE dropped a further 3.62% on Friday to 6,462, while the financials index fell 3.84% to 699.80, and the pound US dollar rose 0.74% to 1.3049. As I see things, the global uncertainty will hit hard and debt will be the centre of the storm. According to the Institute of International Finance, a trade group, the ratio of global debt to gross domestic product hit an all-time high of over 322% in the third quarter of 2019, with total debt reaching close to $253 trillion. Much of the debt building up since the global financial crisis of 2007-08, and it's been in the non-bank corporate sector, where the current disruption to supply chains and reduced global growth implies lower earnings and greater difficulty in debt servicing. In effect, the Panic Not 101 raises the extraordinary prospect of a credit crunch in a world of ultra-low and negative interest rates. As the OECD puts it, in a downturn, some of the disproportionately large recent issuance of BBB bonds, the lowest investment-grade category, could end up being downgraded. That would lead to big increases in borrowing costs because many investors are constrained by regulation or self-imposed restrictions from investing in non-investment-grade bonds. The deterioration in bond quality is particularly striking in the $1.3 trillion global market for leveraged loans, which are loans arranged by syndicates of banks to companies that are heavily indebted or have weak credit ratings. Such loans are called leveraged because the ratio of the borrower's debt to assets or earnings is well above industry norms. New issuance in this sector hit a record $788 billion in 2017, higher than the peak of $762 billion before the crisis. The US accounted for $564 billion of that total. Much of this debt has financed mergers and acquisitions and stock buybacks. Executives have a powerful incentive to engage in buybacks despite very full valuations in the equity markets because they boost earnings per share by shrinking the company's equity capital and thus inflate performance-related pay. Yet this financial engineering is a recipe for systemically weak corporate balance sheets. Exactly. And more central bank liquidity actually will not help. Indeed, it expands debt even more. Perhaps we are approaching that Minsky moment. We will see. Hi, it's Liz Interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin, here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. And so to the local market. Of course, the RBA cut the cash rate this past week in response to recent events, putting the cash rate at a record low 50 basis points. Because the Fed cut more, in fact, the Aussie dollar is looking a little stronger. Having dropped to a record low recently, it ended at 66.50, up 0.56%. That is a problem in that the RBA needs the dollar to go lower to help protect the local economy, and it may in fact signal they should have cut harder, but then again, with only 0.25% in the locker before practically speaking hitting zero bounds because of the RBA's rate corridor, they are caught now. We are now expecting a further emergency rate cut and even quantitative easing in the short order to try to support the economy. And if you want to understand why that support is needed, you should watch my recent show, The State of the Economy in Around 10 Slides, where we discuss Australia's retail sales, which unexpectedly fell in January by 0.3% after the 0.7% decline at the end of last year. It's the first back-to-back decline in retail sales since July-August 2017. Weak wages, the peak of the wildfires, and high household debt levels are the likely culprits. The Australian reported that Australia faces an unprecedented fall in international visitor arrivals from key countries as the Panic Not 101 outbreak feeds a record number of holiday cancellations and a 36% fall in bookings since December. Tourism Australia data revealed a wipeout in international airline bookings from key tourist markets, including China, Britain, Canada, the US, India, Japan, and Singapore. The travel ban on China, Australia's biggest tourism market, with about 1.4 million international visitors each year, has triggered a paralysis in bookings and a flood of forward cancellations from Chinese tourists. Belatedly, the industry are trying to advertise in Europe and the US, but it's going to be too little, too late. S&P cut their growth forecast for Asia-Pacific to 4%, assuming what they call a U-shaped recovery. And they said that Australia is quite vulnerable, with growth in 2020 expected to touch 1.2%, well below trend. Australia's most disrupted sectors employ a large share of workers, which will weaken both the labour market and consumer confidence, S&P said. Services account for around 80% of employment, with accommodation and catering sensitive to tourism and discretionary consumer spending, alone making up over 7%. We expect the Reserve Bank of Australia to cut rates once more to 0.25%. Of course, no one can tell how long the disruption will run. Our modelling suggests the Australian economy is on the verge of a six-month shutdown. And there won't be much international movement. The borders will remain closed, at first by us, and then by everyone else as they recover, but we get sicker. The private sector will hunker down, and the public sector will struggle valiantly with the threat. The ASX 100 dropped 2.8% to 5,157.90, while the ASX Financials dropped 4.8% to 5,397.60. Bank stock prices were hit hard this week. NZ was down 4.73% to 22.14 as it announced further job cuts. CBA slipped 3.67% to 73.93. NAB dropped 5.22% to 22.075. And Westpac was down 4.04% to 21.35. And they confirmed that John McFarlane will take the chair at the bank from the 1st of April. Regionals will crunch, with Bank of Queensland down 4.02% to 6.93, Suncorp down just 2.18% to 11.20, and Bendigo Bank down 8.15% to 7.78. Bendigo did a capital raising recently and remains under pressure. Elsewhere, AFG, the aggregator, slid 7.08% to 223, and Macquarie fell 4.07% to 131.93. Lower rates, of course, crush margins, and most lenders passed on the full 25 basis point cut to mortgage borrowers. They are busily trimming deposit rates further, and savers once again are becoming silent victims in all this. The RBA is, of course, assuming that the banks can lend more as rates fall to drive more consumption. But consumers and businesses are not confident at the moment, and household debt is very high. In addition, many deposit returns are already so close to zero that they cannot recover another 25 basis points. So net-net, rate cuts are eating into bank profits, dividends will be lower, and risks of default are rising among consumers and businesses as the economy supply-side shocks kick in. We think there are limited tools to support the market from here, and in fact, QE will not do much when it comes. Welcome to a Japanisation of the economy. Fitch reported a little change in mortgage arrears in the last quarter of 2019, with Australia's 30-day plus mortgage arrears down one basis point to 1.06% in the fourth quarter from the previous quarter, and one basis point higher from the year earlier. 30-day arrears have been below 1.2% for the last 2.5 years. They make the point that the bushfires occurred in remote or regional areas with low population levels, while the mortgage portfolios typically secured under the RBMS notes are concentrated in densely populated areas that are not directly affected by the bushfires. The Panic Not 101 outbreak could indirectly affect arrears performance due to lower incomes stemming from a fall in tourist numbers following the implementation of travel restrictions, they said. And last Saturday, we saw significant auction results with 2,933 listed and 1,592 cleared, according to CoreLogic, giving a 77.1% weighted average. Sydney was at 81% and Melbourne at 77%. A year ago, there were 2,301 listed and 50.4% cleared. Their home price index was up again with weekly rises of 0.4% in Sydney, 0.3% in Melbourne and 0.12% in Adelaide. Perth managed a 0.08% rise and Brisbane just 0.06%. As a result, there are average quarterly rises of 4.55% in Sydney and 3.82% in Melbourne. From peak to trough, Perth, though, is still down 21% and Sydney is still also in negative territory before any inflation adjustments are applied. And again, these are average prices. On the ground, there will be considerable variations, with many areas still lower than a year back. Rises are weighted towards more expensive property, which had dropped, by the way, the most earlier on. CoreLogic also said that Darwin home prices have fallen for 68 months and is 32.7% below its May 2014 peak. In inflation-adjusted terms, Darwin's dwelling values have declined by around 36% from peak. And Perth is the other housing market that has yet to stage any meaningful recovery, even though it rebounded marginally over the past quarter. Its dwelling values are still 21% below their June 2014 peak, or around 27% lower in real terms. And they also reported in their quarterly rental report that annual rental growth nationally was 1.3%, and that remains below inflation at 1.8%, with national capital city rental growth at 0.8%, even weaker. Sydney's rental growth was 0.5% over the quarter, but down 0.6% over the year, and that remains especially weak, which has pulled down rents nationally. While there are some variations across locations and between houses and units, property investors are in for a torrid time. Recent price growth in both Sydney and Melbourne against soft or negative rental growth has driven gross rental yields into the gutter, with both Sydney and Melbourne house yields well below 3%, near the lowest level on record. Net returns are even worse, and SQM Research released its stock on market report for February, which revealed that property listings rose by 0.2% over the month, but are still down 13.8% year on year. But listings in Sydney and Melbourne bounced by 9.9% and 10% respectively in February. We think home prices will react to the recent uncertainty and rising supply. It's just a matter of timing. The S&P/ASX VIX, which measured the implied volatility of the ASX 200 options, was up 20.47% to 26.68, a new three-year high, so risk is on. The euro Aussie dollar was at 1.6973. The Aussie gold cross was down 0.41% to 2,519. And the Aussie Bitcoin cross was down 0.26% to 13,812. And so in summary, the uncertainty in the outlook is looking decidedly dark. There are few places to hide. And the question now is, how soon will property prices slide back? We are expecting some fiscal stimulus, and it will be interesting to see if it is directed at the property sector. It should not be, as there are more immediate needs among small businesses, but there again, the government does appear to love property. So we will see. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.